Could you briefly introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah, my name's Heidi Hauserman. I'm an associate professor of geography here at Colorado State University.
What else are you teaching here?
So I teach mostly on kind of human-environment relationships and health geography. So I teach a lot of different classes from sort of intro to geography to global health to development geographies and kind of grad level seminars on space, sort of spatial theory in place.
Okay, that's interesting. I read that most of your research investigates the complex conditions under which landscapes change and ensuing socio-environmental ramifications. Can you tell me a little bit more about this in terms of like what research questions and puzzles are you trying to solve?
Mm-hmm.
Just like the overall.
Sure. Yeah, so I've worked on a lot of sort of different objects of analysis, from like coffee production to gold mining to dam construction. And I guess one of the threads through all of that work is kind of trying to understand why are landscapes changing, sort of what are the political economic dimensions that are shaping landscape change, and then what are the implications for people who sort of live and work and play in those landscapes. And one of the things that I've spent a lot of time sort of thinking about is like, how do policies diverge from practices? So sometimes there will be policies about land use or environmental regulation or land use change or particular commodities, but then the practices that we actually see happening on the ground are very different from what's in law and what's in policy. So I'm really interested in kind of like querying that tension and trying to understand what's actually driving landscape change, and then what are the ramifications for people in these areas.
Okay, so you mentioned like the practices are a little different. Could you elaborate a little bit more, like what are some of the things that you've noticed are different?
Yeah, sure. So for example, there's been a huge global gold rush in the last 15 years. So when economic and speculative markets kind of become unstable, the price of gold goes way up. So following the 2008 sort of global financial crisis, and then following the COVID crisis, we see gold prices like hit all-time historic highs. And so there's been just a huge boom in gold mining, especially small-scale gold mining, because it sort of happens with less bureaucratic red tape than large-scale mines, all over the world. And in Ghana, Ghana has very strong environmental laws that are modeled after the U.S. So for instance, no small-scale gold miners should all be Ghanaians. So it's a right that's reserved for Ghanaian nationals. No mining should take place within 300 meters of a water body. There are formalized, institutionalized compensation processes for farmers. And on the ground, none of this is being observed, right? So foreigners are controlling gold mining. They're mining in rivers, on the side of rivers, and farmers are often being dispossessed of land without any compensation. So why and how does that happen? Under what conditions? What are kind of the subjects and the performances and the relationships that allow that type of mining to happen? So most of the gold mining that I'm describing is done by Chinese operators. And the Chinese government is loaning a lot of money to Ghana for infrastructure projects like Bui Dam, which I've also written about. And one of sort of the informal conditions of these large-scale sort of development, international development deals, is that thousands of Chinese miners are allowed into the country for extraction. So you see that, like, you know, it's the sort of some of the relationships and sort of the political economic deals that are mediating mining are happening well beyond sort of the national level policies around environment and mining.
That's interesting. So speaking of Ghana, can you tell me a little bit about your projects there? I read that you're, like you've mentioned, alluvial gold mining, the Buruli Alsa and the Bui Dam. Could you just explain a little bit more what's happening with those projects?
So with the mining that I just described, we've been looking at a lot at like the health implications of mining, because the pits sort of go unremediated for the most part. So you're left with these like thousands, tens of thousands of acres that have been transformed from farmland or forest or fallow land into mining. And then those pits are left unremediated, so they fill with water over time and they become like really hazardous and breeding grounds for vectors. So we've been looking at increases in malaria around mining areas, also just sort of impacts on food insecurity, mercury contamination from mining. I have a new project. My team just landed a big 5-year, $1.5 million NSF grant. So we're going to be actually looking at where the mercury from mining goes. And we hypothesize that a lot of modelers think that mercury is being emitted into the global atmospheric circulation. And we think that it's probably re-entering the environment much more locally, because that assumption that it goes up into global atmospheric circulation is based on the coal stack, which emits contaminants hundreds of feet up in the air. And when miners burn mercury in Ghana, they do it on the ground or on a table. So that's what we'll be working on for the next 5 years around mining. Bui Dam was kind of a one-off. I thought it was going to turn into a long-term project. So we were looking at the development of a dam on a river in Bromahafo region, a very controversial dam for a lot of reasons, including that a lot of people speculated it would never run at full capacity due to climate change. So why do you build this dam that's kind of like doomed from the start? You know, what are sort of the political relationships mediating that? What happens to people who live in this landscape? It was a really, really heartbreaking project to work on. And then Bruley ulcer has been interesting. I had a postdoc at Penn State, which took me into the Bruley ulcer world. And, you know, Western scientists understand it as a sort of caused by a necrotizing skin disease that's caused by a bacteria. So one of the things in Ghana is that treatment of Bruley ulcer is supposed to be free and accessible to all Ghanaians. And what I was seeing early on during my postdoc is that people were being turned away at clinics and they were returning back to their communities to be treated locally. And so I was really interested in understanding like the tension between the official policy and the fact that people were not being treated, and then sort of the different ontologies and practices that were shaping treatment at the local level.
That's interesting. Just going back to what you've been talking about, in terms of the increases in malaria and diseases mm-hmm. that you talked about, how is that affecting the populations around? And in terms like their productivity, have you seen like the impacts?
Yeah, I mean, it's huge, right? So we did a household survey about 5 years after the mining started in these communities. And almost everybody reported that malaria cases were increasing. I think 80% of households had had a malaria case, at least one malaria case within the last 6 months. Most of those cases were in women and children, including people that should have acquired immunity to malaria. And so it's a huge impact. And one of the things that we argue in our malaria paper is that, you know, these are mostly community members that have been dispossessed of farmland. They're food insecure. They are living in really contaminated landscapes, which also compromises immunity and lowers immunity. They're stressed out, especially women, because women are expected to, you know, do the social reproduction around food production for the household. And all of these things sort of combine with the fact that there are more vectors on the landscape to increase people's vulnerability to ill health and malaria in particular. So we see these things as not kind of happening in isolation, but as these processes are very much intertwined. It's hugely impactful. I've known people that have moved out of these communities because of the health and malaria issues. But then again, a lot of people don't have that option. They don't have another place to go. They don't have the means to get somewhere else. So yeah, it's a really big problem.
Okay. And then was the Bui Dam completely constructed, or is it still a project?
It was commissioned, I think, in 2013, okay. And I was there in 2015, and then again in 2017. So it's been a while since I've been there.
What is the impact of having the dam commissioned for the populations around it?
So there were about, I think, above 1,000, less than 2,000 people from two or three communities that were relocated into two new communities. And they had their livelihoods like majorly disrupted, right? So these were river fishermen, farmers who were farming on the floodbanks of the river. And they were given sort of these new settlement houses. They were given farmland that was further away and not as fertile. And they were really upset. They really wanted their old lives and livelihoods back. And so there was this real disconnect between sort of the official discourse that was happening around the dam and how it was, you know, good for Ghana to modernize and how people in the cities needed electricity. And, you know, this was part of sort of economic development and progress. So there was a real tension between sort of the official discourses around the dam and then sort of the really tragic and heartbreaking stories that we were hearing from people in these resettled communities, just about how much they were struggling, how nostalgic they were for kind of this pre-dam lifestyle and livelihoods. Yeah.
So have you traveled to Ghana recently, or are you planning to travel?
Yeah, so I was there in 2022, the summer of 2022 was the last time I was there. And that was sort of getting preliminary data to write this National Science Foundation grant. And so we were really looking in that trip around mercury. So where people were burning mercury, how much mercury they were using. And then we came back and we wrote the proposal, which we submitted a year ago. Everybody told us, you're not going to get this on the first try. Like, you have to apply two or three times to get these things. And so when I say we, I'm talking about myself and Dr. Jackie Gearson, who's a biogeochemist at Michigan State, Edith Parker, who's the Dean of Public Health at the University of Iowa, Elsie Sinderlin, who's an atmospheric modeler and environmental scientist at Harvard, and then Prof. Richard Amankwa and Emmanuel Effa, who are both faculty members at the University of Mines and Technology in Ghana and really long-term collaborators of mine since 2010. So we found out, the team found out last summer that we got it. So that project's going to kick off in January, and we'll be doing field work for the next 5 years. The next 3 years, really intensively, mostly in the summers. And we have some awesome grad students that are helping us on that project. Bernadette Atosona, who I've also known a long time, is a PhD in environmental science at the University of Ghana. And then a couple students here at CSU and Jackie's student at Michigan State. So it's a great team. It's going to be super fun, really interdisciplinary, super international, great team of folks that we're going to be collaborating with for the next 5 years.
Yeah, congratulations on the grant. Thanks. It sounds interesting. I'm looking forward to reading more.
Yeah, we're super excited. Yeah, it'll be really fun. And it's just like some of these folks I've worked with for 14 years, and I just am so excited that I get to keep working with them for the next 5 years, and that we have funding and we build a lot of opportunities into the grant to bring, you know, Ghanaian students to the U.S. for training, to get the Ghanaian faculty and students traveling internationally to conferences. So I'm really excited just about all the different opportunities that are part of professional development within the grant too.
So apart from like the inter-exchange that you've mentioned, are there any other things you're expecting to achieve with the grant or expectations?
Yeah, so we're also doing like a lot of community outreach and education, especially in years 4 and 5 around mercury. So once we kind of know through social science methods and environmental science methods sort of what people know about mercury when they come in contact with it, where exposure happens, but also where is the mercury ending up in the landscape. Once we have a better idea of that, which are kind of the ambitions of year 1 and 2 and 3, then we're going to be doing some really targeted kind of public health interventions and education. So we're going to be working with like muralists. We're going to be working with Ghana Health Services folks, where we might work with some dancers and songwriters to do some very like culturally kind of specific types of education around mercury and mercury risks and how to reduce exposure. So I'm super excited for all of that. We're going to try to do a photography project with high school students in these areas too, to kind of understand landscape change and their experiences of landscape. And I'm super excited for that. And I'm hoping we can find a great Ghanaian photographer to help us out on that portion of the project. So yeah, lots of exciting stuff happening.
That's exciting, mm-hmm. Yeah. So read that you're leading the Human Environment Collective group here in the Department of Anthropology and Geography. Mm-hmm. Could you just tell me a little bit more about
that's
that?
That's just a very fancy name for my like grad student lab. It's not like a formal institutionalized thing. And I have like several grad students working on all sorts of cool stuff, from Rach Neihart's working on, she's a PhD student that's working on kind of environmental justice and green infrastructure in Denver. Zoe Walter Hodge is working on kind of development expertise in Ethiopia around agriculture. Alyssa Matthews is a new student who's working on the Mercury Project with us. So we get together almost every other week to just kind of talk about what's going on in our lives and with our research. And that's just a very fancy name for my grad student group. But we have a ton of fun. Yeah. We have a really awesome group and a really awesome vibe. And we just get along really well. It's super fun to have such a great group of grads.
That's interesting that you're able to bring the grad students together and exchange ideas.
It's
so important for PhD and master's students.
It really is. You have to have a community, and like, they help each other out. They answer a lot of each other's questions. They provide support. It's super important. It's something my advisor was good about at Arizona many, many years ago. And yeah, I've tried to keep that tradition going. Yeah.
That's good. So now moving on to just like a little bit more about you, what led you to this field and career path that you found yourself in?
That's a good question. So I studied abroad in Tanzania as an undergraduate, and I saw a lot of like really interesting things in Tanzania. It was like 1998. It was kind of like at the height of fortress conservation and, you know, conserving new lands for the sake of biodiversity and exclusion of native peoples from those lands, you know, not unlike had been happening for hundreds of years. But I was really interested in kind of these like conflicts around space and conservation and how sort of native people might be more sort of active participants in the creation of conservation and wildlife areas. And so I taught English on a Fulbright in South Korea after my undergrad. And through that experience, I learned I really loved teaching and that I was good at teaching. But I kept kind of thinking about like these things that I'd seen in Tanzania and these questions that I had over like environment and human environment relationships. So I came back from Korea and I started teaching in the Oregon public schools. But I started looking at grad school programs, and I knew that I wanted a field that studied human-environment relationships, and I knew I wanted a field that did it creatively and that used mixed methods. And when I started looking at different disciplines, geography was really the place that I thought was doing these things in the most creative, kind of genuine way. And so I applied to geography graduate programs, and then kind of, you know, things just sort of took off from there.
And so what have been like some of the eye-opening experiences from your research and career? What have been some things that have really like stood out?
You know, an early one that comes to mind in Tanzania when I was like 20, you know, I was so young. I was an undergrad, and there was this component of this study abroad program where you had to like do an independent study. And so I was off by myself in this area next to a new national park, and I was doing interviews as part of this independent study, and people were just talking about how much they hated the park and how they were like, people were burning down the park entrance in the night, and they were like setting fire to the agroforestry like nurseries that the World Wildlife Fund for Nature had established. And that was so like eye-opening to me that like people living in these areas were so angry and so frustrated with kind of their exclusion from development and conservation processes that I just remember being kind of blown away by that. And it really reoriented what I always had thought was like good. Oh, conservation is good. Wildlife, you know, World Wildlife Fund for Nature is good. They have a cute panda logo. They must be good, right? So I think that was like really mind-blowing for like a 20-year-old. And it's so funny because I found my thesis that I wrote as part of that independent study recently somewhere. And it's very similar to the work I do today around like tensions between like local desires and experiences and like more kind of national and international kind of development. So that's one moment. You know, I think I'm constantly blown away by just kind of the generosity of people. I've been super lucky in my research and in my travels to just interact with such amazing people and have such incredible collaborators. And so I think that's something that still like really touches me and I'm very grateful for. Yeah.
That's interesting. And then what have been some challenging aspects of your research?
I think that sometimes just the kind of emotional toll of some of these stories and projects, you know, I always joked that my next project was going to be like about enchiladas and puppies because like the mining and the Brule ulcer and the like, you know, the displacement from the dam, it's really heavy stuff. And it's important, I think, to detail like the outcomes of some of these processes for people. You know, I think the work is important, but it's also, it's intense and it can be a lot. I've had to like spend months away from my kids, you know, I have little kids. And so I go to Ghana for 3 weeks or a month, and that's hard too. I'm gonna take my oldest kiddo to Ghana with me next summer for the first time, which is super exciting. So that's a challenge, I think. Mostly I feel very like lucky and privileged to do this work, but those are two kind of things that stand out. And I have a new project on edible insects in Mexico. So my dissertation research was all in Mexico with coffee farmers. So I also have a new project there working with coffee farmers on edible insects that is really cool and kind of not as depressing so far as I can tell. So I guess that's as close to enchiladas and puppies as I'm going to get, but yeah.
So you did your dissertation in Mexico, mm-hmm. and then what sparked the interest in Africa? Was it the experience in Tanzania?
Or? It was actually the postdoc. So yeah, it was funny. I went to grad school to work on Tanzania, and when I got there, the guy I was going to work with was on sabbatical. And Diana Liverman, who is a big kind of climate change adaptation scholar, was at Arizona, and I had a couple classes with her, and she kind of snatched me and got me working in Mexico. So that was sort of the switch to Mexico. But it's interesting that then I had a postdoc at Penn State that was working on a big five-year NSF project that was in Ghana on Brule ulcer. And so that kind of took me to Ghana. And now next year I'm on sabbatical and I'll be going back to Mexico. But yeah, it's been interesting to kind of jump back and forth and see a lot of similarities. Like, of course, many differences between these different sites, but also in a lot of ways, a lot of similarities too.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay, and then finally, what's a piece of advice that you would give to grad students, those thinking of going to grad school, mm-hmm. or early career academics?
So early career academics, I would tell them not to be afraid to say no to things. I think sometimes people who are like new assistant professors just think they have to say yes to everything and take on the world. And it's too much. It's a lot, you know, and you just have to really learn early how to say no and how to draw boundaries and how to take care of yourself or you burn out. I think to grad students these days, I would say, you know, the job market, if you're hoping to have an academic career, has become so competitive. So I would be very strategic, if that is your goal, to do certain things in grad school to set yourself up to be really a viable candidate for tenure track jobs. So I work a lot with my grad students, if that's their goal, to just make their CV look as sort of robust as possible. And also to have a plan B in case that doesn't work out. And then people who are going to grad school, I think I would say find an advisor that you really get along with and who's really going to have your back, because that's one of the most important relationships as a grad student. And I think a lot of my undergrads, I see that they don't understand how close that relationship is. And so find someone that you like their work and that they're interested in you, but also that's just a good person and that's going to have your back and really support you. Because there are a lot of people out there that aren't like that. And so you got to beat the bushes and find the good folks.
Yeah, that's some really good advice. So thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thank you. Thanks so much for asking me to participate in this.
Yeah, sure.
Appreciate it.